From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the 121st running of the Boston Marathon. The winners were both Kenyan runners making their Boston Marathon debuts. Jordan Hasse was the first American woman to finish, and it's her very first marathon.
Our sports psychologist told me at the end it's just about getting to the finish, and I was just focused on finishing myself.
Also, Catherine Schweitzer, the first woman to officially run the Boston Marathon, remembers that 1967 race.
I will forget the man who walked out in the street and shouted at me, "Go home to your husband and make him dinner." But I will always remember the woman who fell down on her knees at the roadside and said, "Come on, honey, do it for all of us."
Plus, how much rest a marathon runner needs post-race.
Rest is vital, and all of our measurements would suggest that rest is not counterproductive. If anything, it's productive.
All that coming up on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. On this Marathon Monday,
let's hear it for Edna Kiplagat as she comes down the stretch. Running down Boylston, closing in on the finish line. What a perfectly executed race.
Kenyan runner Edna Kiplagat there, winning the elite woman's race in 2 hours, 21 minutes, and 52 seconds. Kenyans were victorious in both the women's and men's races. Geoffrey Kiru took the elite men's race in 2 hours, 9 minutes, 27 seconds. In total, 30,000 runners registered for this year's marathon. Here's Boston Mayor Marty Walsh.
You know, there's tens of thousands of visitors from all over the world here to our city today, watching the marathon, running in the marathon, participating in the marathon, and it's an exciting day. It always has been an exciting day for the city.
WBUR's Alex Ashlock has been following the marathon all day, and he joins us now. Hi there, Alex.
Hey, Deb, how you doing?
Okay, so what's the scene like down there at the finish line?
It's just amazing. This is prime time for finishers of the marathon, people who started out in Hopkinton maybe at 11 o'clock or 11:30, hundreds of people pouring across the finish line. Every second or so, Boylston Street is just packed with people. It's wall-to-wall, sidewalk-to-sidewalk. People are celebrating. Boston's the holy grail for marathon runners. A lot of these people, you know, had to qualify to get into this race, and they're just celebrating something they've been waiting a long time to do and have done a lot of hard work to get to this point, so it's always a great thing to see.
And it was quite a day for the Kenyans, right? The record setting.
Yes. Once again, there were records set in the wheelchair races, but the men's race and the women's race, the elite runners, both won by Kenyans, as you said. The men's race came down to a big-time duel. Geoffrey Kiru, as you said, won the duel. He's making his Boston debut today. He and Galen Rupp broke away from the pack up on Heartbreak Hill at about 21 miles, and then Kiru put the hammer down. He ran a mile in 4 minutes and 30 seconds for his 24th mile of the marathon. Rupp had no answer for that and ended up finishing second. Kiplagat, as we just heard, won the race on the women's side. She was also running Boston for the first time, but she's a terrific, experienced marathon runner. She's won marathons in London and in New York, and a world championship, and she's added the Boston Marathon title to that excellent resume. The records were set in the wheelchair races. Marcel Hoog won his third straight Boston Marathon. He set a course record today. Manuela Char won the women's push rim wheelchair. She also set a course record, basically a world record. She's the first woman to ever break 90 minutes for a wheelchair marathon, Deb. For some perspective on that, the winning time for the women's winner last year, an hour, 42 minutes and 16 seconds. Char's time today was 1 hour and 28 minutes and 17 seconds. American women in the elite race did well today. For the first time since 1991, the U.S. had two women in the top four. Jordan Hasse, running her first ever marathon, finished third. She ran 2 hours and 23 minutes, Deb. No woman has ever run her first marathon faster. No American woman, I should say, has ever run her first marathon faster. But the real laurels go today to Edna Kiplagat. She celebrated with her children.
Carlos and Wendy, they came to support me, and I am happy because they gave me ample time to train and rest. And today, I'm so happy that they are here.
And Alex, what about Meb Keflezighi? This is his last marathon?
Yeah, he's retiring from competitive marathoning at the end of the year. This was his last competitive Boston Marathon. He's going to run New York in the fall, and he says that's going to be it. It was an emotional day for him. He won that 2014 race, the first race after the bombings, and he talked about that and how much he enjoys Boston after the race.
I enjoy the crowd. It was an amazing crowd to be able to chant USA, USA, go Meb, and you're our hero, and Boston strong, Meb strong. You hear it. You know, people chant the USA, USA, and it was fun. I enjoyed every bit of it.
And Alex,
he always feeds off. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, at the finish line, he kissed the hand of Bill Richard, father of Martin Richard, who was killed in the bombings, right?
Yeah, very emotional. When he won in 2014, he wore the names of all of the victims, the three people who were killed at the finish line by the bombings, Martin Richard, Lingzi Liu, and also Crystal Campbell. He also had Sean Collier's name on his bib, the MIT police officer. But he talked today about that emotional moment regarding the Richard family.
I was there. I just got saved by 5-6 minutes. I had an appointment, but I have 8-year-old daughter. That's why the first time I saw Martin, that could have been my daughter. So it's personal. You know, I try at the same time, you know, I try to be there for them.
Alex, were there any unexpected wins or losses today?
No, this isn't really unexpected necessarily, but I want to mention Tatyana McFadden, the wheelchair racer. She had a streak of 4 straight Boston Marathon wins. And she, too, like Meb Keflezighi, has become very close to some of the families of the victims of the marathon bombing and some of the survivors as well. She finished 4th today, but she had just gone through some surgery for blood clots. We talked about this on Friday. I think she had a surgery something like 2 weeks ago.
Right.
So just the fact that she even completed the race today was really amazing. And on the men's wheelchair side, South African Ernst van Dijk finished 2nd for the 2nd straight year. He has 10 wins here overall. That's more than anybody else, but he couldn't quite make it today.
Anyone else you're following, Alex?
Yeah, I should mention the American men. I did talk about the women in the elite race. They had 2 in the top 4. But the American men had a great showing today, led by Galen Rupp in 2nd. There were 5 other Americans in the top 10, so that really bodes well for the future for American long-distance running. Galen Rupp is clearly at the head of that pack. He's actually only run 3 marathons so far, Deb. He won the Olympic trials in 2016. He won a bronze medal in Rio last summer. And now he has a 2nd-place finish in Boston. That's not bad for your first 3 marathons.
No, not bad at all. WBUR's Alex Ashlock. We'll check in with you later in this hour. Alex, thanks so much.
Sounds good, Deb.
And now let's get a look at the security for this year's race. Increased security has been part of the race since the 2013 marathon bombings. Here's Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency spokesman Chris Bessie.
We've got info and footage coming in from our drone partners that we're working with. We've got a downlink from the state police helicopter feed, radio systems that are coming in with information. So really a whole bunch of different tools for us to gather information and be on top of what's going on.
WBUR's Fred Tice is at Audubon Circle on Beacon Street. He's been following the security measures this year. Hi there, Fred.
Hi, Deb. How are you?
Okay. Well, tethered drones and other things. What's different about the security this year?
Yeah, as Chris Bessie mentioned there, those tethered drones are new. They just have 2 this year. They're trying them out in Hopkinton. They were using them at an altitude of about 400 feet to look down on the crowds, to look for unusual patterns. And I guess after this, they'll decide whether they want to use more next year. The other thing that's new is over the years, we've had big trucks blocking access to the marathon route here and there. But they really beefed that up here at Audubon Circle, where Park Street intersects with Beacon Street and where Beacon Street moves from Brookline into Boston. There are 3 big Boston Public Works trucks, snow plows, blocking Park Street. And so along the route all the way to Copley Square, we were told by Boston police. The other thing that I saw that I thought was really interesting was out in Hopkinton at the command center at NEMA there, where Chris Bessie was, there was this map that's kind of like the Google Maps when you click so you can see the traffic. You know, mm-hmm. That traffic, it's red, green means there's not a whole lot of traffic. And they were following the masses of runners. So where the greatest concentration of runners was,
wow,
that's where the red was.
Any problems reported, Fred?
No, you know, I spoke to Chris Messier again about half an hour ago, and he said it's really quiet. They're mainly concerned today about heat stroke, and, you know, they're anticipating being able to help people at medical tents all along the way. Here, where I am, there was a young man who was just been wheeled into an ambulance. I do not know what he had, but he looked like he was just kind of exhausted, and they're pulling him away now. But they're not really anticipating any big problems besides that.
You know, every year, particularly since the bombings, Fred, officials talk about trying to strike this balance, right, between increased security and making sure everyone's safe, but also making sure that the race is accessible and doesn't feel threatening. Do you think that they struck that balance?
You know, it's really my impression that they did. I think you hear a lot of complaints from runners, you know, because so many of them have to start downtown and take the buses out, and they have to bring their belongings in clear plastic bags. You know, it's quite a schlep for them. But for spectators, it really depends on where you're going to go, right? If you're going to go near Copley Square and near the finish line, it's kind of tough to go through. You have to go through a whole bunch of security checkpoints. But I'm here at Audubon Circle on Beacon Street, and you can just walk right up or take the key to the St. Mary's stop, for example, the C line, and just walk right to the marathon route. There's plenty of room for you to go right up front and start high-fiving the runners. So I think it varies a lot on where on the route you want to go.
All right. WBUR's Fred Tice, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Deb.
Teams of first responders are also at the ready and treating runners for any ailments, particularly, as Fred mentioned, heat exhaustion or dehydration. WBUR's Martha Biebinger has been following the medical teams along the marathon route today. She's by the finish line right now. Hi there, Martha.
Hi there, Deb.
So what have the medical teams been seeing?
They're seeing a lot of dehydration and cramping. Probably numbers a little higher than an average marathon. Nothing like 2012, you remember, when we had the really hot day. Now, if today had been yesterday when it climbed into the 80s, we might have seen that. Today still, though, with temperatures in the mid-70s, is much warmer than most people in the Boston area would have trained in. Deb, you can imagine they were training in 30 and 40-degree weather.
Right.
So very few of them did any long runs in a 70-degree sunny day.
Has it been busy?
Yes, it's definitely busy. It doesn't seem like they're having emergency runs to the hospital. They've transported from this downtown area maybe in the range of 20 people to a hospital, but those are not people who had, as I said, an acute need. They just weren't responding to rehydration as quickly as folks in the tent hoped they would.
Now, a lot of the medical operations were really credited with saving people's lives in the 2013 bombings, but some things were then upgraded post-bombings as well. What do the operations look like sort of behind the scenes?
Well, the main tent at the finish line is really a mobile emergency room. They can do quite a lot in this tent, and they set it up that way so that they don't flood area emergency rooms, and those emergency rooms stay open for spectators and such, for people from the community who need assistance. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they have the 26 tents along the route. Many of them are staffed with 20 or 30 people, range from doctors, paramedics, their counselors at some of them. And there are several hazmat units out there that have even more specialized equipment. So they really do quite a range of activities.
Are a lot of runners still coming through where you're at, Martha?
They are, yep. I might just mention that I have to get up and move because someone is throwing up next to me. So the heat is really getting to some people. And
yikes.
And they are, but you know, they've got wheelchairs right here ready to grab anybody who needs help. They've got really anything, they can respond to just about any need a runner would have within seconds.
Okay, well, hopefully you can get out in seconds as well. WBUR's Martha Biebinger, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Deb.
Stay with us. Coming up, the first woman to officially run the Boston Marathon. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. 50 years ago, on a cold April morning, Catherine Switzer stood on the starting line of the Boston Marathon. She was the only woman in the field and the first woman to run the race with an official bib. Here's how a TV announcer described it that day.
A record field of 601 starters braved chilly winds and a steady drizzle in the 71st Boston Marathon. The world's most famous foot race even attracts a leggy lady, Kay Switzer of Syracuse. Officials tried to jostle her off the road.
Catherine Switzer's run has become a big part of the story of women participating in the marathon and gender equity in sports in general. We recently sat down with Switzer to hear more of her reflections from that day.
My entering the Boston Marathon in 1967 was a reward from my coach, Arnie Briggs. He didn't believe a woman could run no matter what. But he said if I would prove to him in practice that I could do it, he'd take me to the Boston Marathon. So I trained mightily with him, and one day we ran 26 miles, and then I said, let's run another five to make sure we can do it. We ran 31 miles, and he was so impressed after he passed out, he was so impressed that women had inherent potential in endurance and stamina, and he helped me sign up for the event. I thought we could just go and jump into the race. He said, no, no, no. You have to fill out the entry form. You have to follow the rules. And I said, but maybe it's a men's only event. And he said, no, it's not. There's nothing here that says that it's for men only. And there's nothing on the entry form about gender. So I said, well, then how come women aren't running? And he said, because they don't believe they can. They're afraid to run. And I said, okay, so we fill out the entry form together. I paid my $2 entry fee, but I signed the form KV Switzer with my initials. I began using my initials because my dad had misspelled Catherine on my birth certificate, and I spent my whole life with it being misspelled. And so by signing KV Switzer, it solved the problem of misspelling my name. And when the form went in, they obviously thought it was from a man, and they issued me numbers. They thought that I was trying to fool them, and I wasn't, and I was trying to follow the rules. So what happened is we woke up that morning with snow on the ground and the headwind sleet and freezing cold. It was about 34, 35 degrees. So everybody in the race looked alike. We had pulled everything out of our suitcases and drawers that we had with us and put them on, and so from a distance, I looked like just one of the guys. The men on the race welcomed me. They thought it was great. And off I went. And it was marvelous for the first mile. And then suddenly, the press truck passed us. They were taking pictures of us and going crazy seeing a woman in the race wearing bib numbers. This had never happened before. And for a while, we thought that this was really great news, and we were waving at them when all of a sudden, behind me, I heard fast-moving footsteps turn to see a ferocious face screaming, get the hell out of my race and give me those numbers. It was the race director, furious that a woman was in his race wearing a bib. And he grabbed me, and he threw me back, and he tried to pull off my bib numbers. My coach screamed, leave her alone. She's okay. I've trained her. My boyfriend, who was an ex-All-American football player, threw a shoulder charge into the official and sent him out of the race instead. So at that moment, I was so embarrassed and so terrified and so upset, I kind of didn't know what to do. I thought, should I quit? And then I thought, no, I can't quit, because if I do that, nobody will believe women can run. Nobody will believe we deserve to be here. And I turned to my coach and I said, now I have to finish this race on my hands and my knees if I have to, because I have to prove that women deserve to be here and can do the distance. And he said, okay, let's just slow it down and get it all together. By mile two, my boyfriend, who had hit the official, turned to me in great anger and said I was getting him in all kinds of trouble and he was never going to make the Olympic team because of me, and I ran too slow anyway. And I remember how embarrassed I felt that we were having a boyfriend-girlfriend argument in the middle of the Boston Marathon. So there were three of us, my coach, myself, and a guy from our cross-country team. And we went into the most incredible trough, which often happens after you have an experience like that shocks and raises your adrenaline. When the adrenaline goes, then you feel so tired, you feel like you can barely move. And for the next, I would say, 6 miles, we were kind of in this trough and then slowly emerged. The next memory was my boyfriend walking up in front of us, and he didn't know we were coming up behind him. And I caught him up, and he pretended like he hadn't been walking. And he said, oh, walk with me. And I said, no, I'm sorry. As slow as I go, I have momentum. Then the next memory, of course, is climbing through the hills. And when we got up Heartbreak Hill, and then down the other side, I turned to my coach. I said, when is Heartbreak coming? And he said, you just went over Heartbreak. And I said, I did. I didn't even realize it. And he said, only you would not realize that we just ran over Heartbreak Hill. I had massive blisters in my arches and between my toes, and I was beginning to bleed through my shoes. But I just refused to even accept this. I had to put it out of my mind. And we were just holding on, and we were absolutely frozen. It was just miserable. And then all of a sudden, we were coming along Commonwealth and heading to Hereford Street. I was very afraid, and my coach was, that maybe a policeman was going to try to pull us from the race before the finish when nobody was looking. And in fact, the official had gone ahead and told the cops to pull us, and they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't get involved, which is great. And we made a right on Hereford. We turned left on Boylston, and there was the finish. And we were not exactly overjoyed, but we were tremendously relieved. We'd done it. We'd never walked. We completed the whole thing. The three of us were together. I try to forget bad things and remember good things. So I will forget the man who walked out in the street and shouted at me, go home to your husband and make him dinner. But I will always remember the woman who fell down on her knees at the roadside and said, come on, honey, do it for all of us.
The man who grabbed Switzer was Jock Semple, the race director for the Boston Marathon at the time. The iconic photo of Semple trying to grab Switzer and knock her off the course is believed to have transformed women's distance running.
Semple never really apologized by saying, I'm sorry. But in 1973, he came to me on the start line and planted a big kiss on my cheek. And in his wonderful Scottish brogue said, come on, lass, let's get a wee bit of notoriety, and turned me around to a bank of television cameras. That was his way of saying he was sorry. We became very good friends, because how could you not love somebody who changed your life and gave you so much, so positive, even out of a negative? And how could you not love somebody who gave the world one of the most galvanizing photos in women's rights history?
Saying she wants to continue to be part of that history, Switzer is running the marathon again this year. She says the race still is an important symbol.
The Boston Marathon, in a funny way, is a microcosm of society. It's changed so completely in 50 years. Let's go from a man trying to throw me out of the race to seeing almost 50-50 runners, men and women. They're not running to be elite. They're not running to lose 5 pounds. They're running because they're empowered. They're running because their lives have been changed so positively by the sense of accomplishment and self-esteem that they have gained from running. And this translates into all areas of their lives. Running is a force wholly for good, and it is a joyful, wonderful, almost gender-free experience. We're out there as runners together. It is, in a way, the ideal of the way the world should be.
That's Catherine Switzer. She's the first woman to officially run the Boston Marathon, and she's running the course today. She is now 70 years old. At this moment, Catherine Switzer is still running. She just turned onto Beacon Street in Chestnut Hill. She's running with 125 people today. They're all raising money for her foundation, 261 Fearless. It's named after the number on the bib that Jock Semple tried to tear off of her during her first Boston run. The foundation promotes women's running around the world. After today's marathon, how long should runners rest? And at what point might they start to lose some of their fitness gains? Well, a new Massachusetts General Hospital study reinforces the idea that rest is important, especially after a test of endurance like a marathon. The study goes as far as suggesting that it's okay for some runners to take several weeks off. Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog, is here to tell us more. Hi there, Carrie.
Hey, Deb.
So I understand that many runners have a hard time taking a break from their strenuous fitness routines once the marathon is over?
Yeah, you run, it's hard to stop, right? But on Common Health Today, we feature a story by reporter Jeremy Relosa that could help them slow down. The headline is, fitness gains persist even weeks after you ease off, marathon study suggests.
Okay, so tell us about that study.
Okay, so as we were saying, a lot of runners and other serious athletes worry that after a big push, like training for a marathon, marathon, if you take a lot of time off, it'll cause you to lose ground. You'll lose fitness or the health and fitness benefits that you gained. So these researchers at Mass General wanted to find out how true that is and what happens. They wanted to measure what actually changes in a runner's body when the race is over and how quickly they lose their conditioning when they ease off of these long training runs that they've done before something like a marathon. So here's Dr. Aaron Baggish. He's the director of the Cardiovascular Performance Program at Mass General, and he's a runner himself who's co-medical director of the marathon.
What we wanted to do was capture where they were at their point of peak fitness before the race, and then what happened as their body saw less exercise over the next 2 months.
So this research team found a couple of dozen runners who ran in last year's Boston Marathon, and they asked the runners to come in three separate times. The first one was before the marathon when they were really in tip-top form, before they even started tapering off in advance of the race. And then after the marathon, they came in after 4 weeks of what's called detraining, and then after 8 weeks of detraining.
So what's detraining? No exercise at all?
No, it's just sort of like the ratcheting down, right? Like they just don't keep up their really tough routine from before the race. And in this studies, in this study, the runners were asked to limit their exercise to just 2 hours a week of cardio, which was a big drop from their marathon training.
And so then how were their abilities measured after that?
Well, so every time the runners came in, they were asked to go on a run, but on a treadmill. They were told to run as long as they could as the treadmill slowly inclined. So it got steeper and steeper and steeper. Here's how one participant, Alexis Druvitsky, described the experience.
And we would get on the treadmill and they would strap us into this very Star Wars looking mask to sort of gauge our breathing and our output. And they said, run as absolutely long as you can. And when you feel like you're really going to drop, grab the handlebars and we'll stop it.
So they'd run almost until they dropped. And all the while, Dr. Baggish's team would monitor the runner's vitals, their blood pressure, their oxygen intake, their heart activity as they were running, and it got harder and harder. Plus, the researchers also watched a bunch of other health measures through blood tests, like cholesterol levels.
And they essentially found that the runners did not suddenly become less fit if they stopped exercising for a while?
Well, not suddenly. Here's what Dr. Baggish says.
Probably the most dramatic changes that we saw were in the structure of the heart. The heart actually shrunk down by 4 and then again by 8 weeks in different ways. First, the left heart started to reduce in size, and then the right heart followed suit.
So ultimately, again, these hearts were changing sizes by like 10 to 20%. So did you even know that hearts could do this, Deb, like significantly change their size in just a few weeks?
No, but it sounds bad. And if the heart is shrinking, this did affect their athletic ability?
Well, so you would think so, but that's kind of the surprising thing. Dr. Baggish says that the most important takeaway from this study is that taking these 8 weeks off didn't significantly change the athlete's fitness levels. He says that our hearts have the ability to change sizes or to oscillate within a certain range and still be pretty much just as healthy. So even though the sizes of the participants' hearts did shrink, they were actually just as healthy as when they were at the peak of their physical fitness for the marathon. And they were still able to take in the same amount of oxygen, which is an important measure of your physical fitness.
And what did the participants say about how they felt? And could they run as well? Did they do the tests as well?
Well, so that's where it gets a little contradictory. Their perceived exertion, it seemed to them like it did become more difficult to keep up on the treadmill and that they couldn't keep going quite as easily or as long. But the physiological findings were that their fitness levels had not significantly changed. Now, we should say these are just preliminary findings. They haven't been published yet, although they've been presented at a conference. But it's something to be explored.
Mm-hmm. So does this study have implications for those of us who are not marathon runners?
Well, yes. So first of all, Dr. Baggish says it's just helpful to know how quickly beginning or ending an exercise regime can affect the size of a person's heart. But the main takeaway is just kind of this confirmation for marathon runners and probably other endurance athletes like triathletes or cyclists or rowers that rest and recovery won't blow up all your hard-won gains. Here's Dr. Baggish.
Rest and recovery after a marathon is not going to force you to lose ground. That there's always a concern among runners that taking time off after they run is going to result in losses in health gains or losses in fitness. And what we saw is that really out through 4 and then 8 weeks, that a lot of the good benefits of running we're still durable.
So he's saying, don't think of rest as counterproductive. It's actually productive. Now, I would like to note here, Deb, that this doesn't mean stay on the couch forever, right? Like on Facebook, the most popular comment in response to this post was someone who wrote, that's great to know because I'm still resting from that time I went to the gym 3 years ago. We do not mean that. But for athletes who need to figure out how much rest to take between bouts of training, this could be helpful.
And is there a set amount of rest time that's recommended?
In a word, no. It can depend on your body. It can depend on what type of exercise you're doing. But Dr. Bagish says, you know, rest is healing. It's when your body builds itself. And he believes you just shouldn't stint on your rest.
I mean, I'm a firm believer in everyone backing off very dramatically after a marathon for some period of time. But again, runners typically will figure out successfully how to do that. For some people, it's a week. For some people, it's 4 weeks. For some people, it may be 8 weeks. But what I think our study does is gives people some reassurance that they can err on the side of that being longer and not lose too much.
And do we know, Carrie, what would happen after 8 weeks if detraining continued?
We don't know the answer to that. We don't know at what point, you know, you really are becoming sedentary and it could actually be detrimental to your health. But Dr. Bagish's Mass General Research team says they do hope to study that in the near future.
All right. Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog. You can find a link to Jeremy Relosa's post on Common Health at our website, radioboston.org. Carrie, thanks as always.
Welcome.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll check in on the Red Sox, who are playing their traditional Patriots Day game today. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We want to check in on the runners just finishing the 121st Boston Marathon now. WBUR's Alex Ashlock has been with us all day, and he's at the finish line again. Hi there, Alex.
Hey, Deb. How you doing?
Okay, so what's the scene like there?
Well, there's lots of people right now passing me that need a lot of rest and recovery. Mm. I think they're going to be on couches tomorrow. But these are all people who just finished running 26.2 miles. And the thing I'm thinking is, it's just unbelievable to me how many people can run a marathon. I mean, 30,000 people in the field today. Hundreds of people are crossing the finish line every minute here. They're coming down Boylston Street. They've just finished the marathon. They have looks of just sheer joy on their face, and they're also limping a little bit. I'm standing by the medical tent. They're taking a few people in wheelchairs. The weather has turned a little bit cloudy now, so I don't think the heat is an issue on the course, but it's just great to see all these people who have achieved this goal, you know, of running the Boston Marathon, probably the most famous marathon in the world, and they just did it.
Right. And so no major issues or anything today, Alex, medical issues or security issues or anything else?
Not that I'm aware of. Again, it was a little bit hot earlier in the day when I was covering the men's race. I was in the men's truck. It was very sunny, and the men were drinking a lot of water. They were going to the side of the road, getting water from the water stops, dumping it on their heads, dumping it on their caps, putting their caps back on. So I think they were feeling the heat, but I don't really think it had any effect on the race. I know the wheelchair racers didn't talk about the heat at all. So I just don't think it's been a big issue. I think there was some concern, and the officials had extra water and ice on the course. So it looks pretty good. These people that are coming in, they look pretty good.
And how late will this go tonight? Like when do we know when the last person might cross the finish line?
That's a good question. Before I answer that, I think we on Friday talked about the man who was going to try to complete 50 straight Boston Marathons, uh-huh. Ben Beach. He just passed me. So he finished his 50th consecutive Boston Marathon.
Congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations to him. So I guess in terms of how long this is going to go on, if you started your Boston Marathon in the last wave, there were four waves of the big, you know, bulk of the field. That would have probably been at maybe 11, 11:15. If you're running a four-hour marathon, 12:15, 1:15, 2:15, maybe a five-hour marathon, I think there'll be people crossing the finish line for at least a couple more hours, I would imagine. But the bulk of the people, they really finish, you know, in this 3 to 4:30, I think, kind of window. I mean, they're just really, literally, I'm just looking at hundreds of people who are crossing the finish line at the same time. So it's just a great scene down here on Boylston Street.
All right, WBUR's Alex Ashlock at the Boston Marathon finish line. He'll stay with us through All Things Considered as well. Alex, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Deb.
And some participants in today's marathon are working as a team, with one runner pushing a wheelchair-bound teammate. Perhaps the most well-known pair was Dick Hoyt and his son Rick, who was diagnosed with cerebral palsy. The Hoyts completed 32 Boston Marathons together. Their final run was last year. The Hoyts and the other wheelchair runner teams have one wheelchair maker in central Massachusetts to thank for helping them get across the finish line. WBUR Shira Springer traveled to the machine shop where running wheelchairs are custom made.
It's a Saturday afternoon at Southbridge Tool and Manufacturing in Dudley. A welder is working on an aluminum wheelchair frame.
We're 30 chairs behind on orders, which I guess is a good problem to have, but I don't like to have that problem. I want to just build them and get them out.
Mike DiDonato's family owns Southbridge Tool. Typically, the company makes aluminum catwalks, jet engine tools, and ladders for water towers. But DiDonato takes the most pride in the wheelchairs. When I ask him why, DiDonato gets teary-eyed.
We're changing people's lives. Every chair that goes out, we know who it goes out to. We pretty much know, what issue there may be with them, why they can't walk, why they need a chair. So we get a personal, it's person to person.
The wheelchairs are designed for riders who cannot push themselves. Some have cerebral palsy, some traumatic brain injuries, and some are quadriplegics. Each chair is designed to be as comfortable as possible for riders. That includes custom sizing and custom padding. The three wheelchairs are also as light as possible for runners. They use handlebars raised to chest height to push and steer. It all started when Dick Hoyt walked into the machine shop. In the running world, Dick Hoyt and his son Rick are legends. They've completed over 1,000 races together, including 32 Boston Marathons, with Dick pushing and Rick riding. They're known as Team Hoyt. The Hoyts live nearby. And that day, the Hoyts told DiDonato they needed a new wheelchair, and they needed it fast. The 2010 Boston Marathon was 2 months away.
I just put my hand out, shook Dick's hand, and said, "We're going to make it for you."
They made a crude steel wheelchair that didn't look pretty, but it worked for Team Hoyt. After that, Dick Hoyt would come by the shop and suggest design changes. Now, DiDonato and one of his welders brainstorm ways to make the chairs better.
Late night coffee, welding, and Led Zeppelin, because we crank Zeppelin on the radio, and we're just working here late to catch up and to work on prototype stuff as well.
The current model can be taken apart and shipped anywhere. Orders come in regularly from around the world. DiDonato expects to make 125 chairs this year, and every customer is like family.
Nick, what's up, buddy? Good to see you.
You feeling good?
Yeah.
What's up, buddy? Hey, how are you?
DiDonato hugs rider Nick Draper and runner Ted Painter. They will be racing in today's Boston Marathon. They head out to an empty parking lot. Painter easily maneuvers the chair and checks in with Draper as they go. Painter almost looks like he's sprinting.
How do you feel, Nick?
Yeah, I think he likes the crowd at the Boston Marathon. It's just raw the whole way from the beginning to the end, and I think that's what you kind of like most about it, right?
Yeah.
I asked Draper how fast they plan to go in Boston.
It's damn fast.
Painter says they hope to finish in under 3 hours. That would be damn fast and close to a personal best.
He's good to go. That's okay. Don't
chill. Right, you're good, honey. I gotta pull the pillows out. Hold on. Thank you.
DiDonato is a runner too. He competes with Kyle Brodeur, who lives in Charlton. Several years ago, a chance meeting brought them together. Now, inside Southbridge Tool, DiDonato helps Brodeur into a running chair. Races give DiDonato the best sense of how well the chairs work. But that's not the main reason he runs. He does it for Brodeur. DiDonato and Brodeur call themselves Team Unstoppable. I ask Brodeur how he came up with the name. He answers through a computerized speech device.
Because I'm unstoppable in everything I do. I have had 27 surgeries to date, but when I'm racing it makes me feel unstoppable again.
Almost 20 years ago, Brodeur was left severely injured and wheelchair-bound when his family's car was hit by a drunk driver. DiDonato talks about giving Brodeur back a sport.
Anybody in our chair, they are athletes.
They won't be on the Boston Marathon course today, but DiDonato will still be following his chairs closely.
That report from WBUR's Shira Springer. Well, along with today's Boston Marathon, the Red Sox played their customary Patriots Day home game, and they beat the Tampa Bay Rays 4-3. Over the weekend, the Red Sox marked a significant anniversary, Jackie Robinson's first Major League game. It was 70 years ago Saturday that Robinson broke the color barrier in baseball, playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers against the Boston Braves. Robinson inspired generations of Americans, including former Boston Mayor Ray Flynn. Only a Game's Karen Gibbon has her story.
Ray Flynn was a 10-year-old sports fan the first time he met Jackie Robinson.
All I ever wanted, I can say it now, I'm not running for political office, but all I ever wanted to be was play for the Celtics or for the Red Sox, not be mayor.
Flynn says he probably should have played shortstop because he had a good throwing arm, but he played second base because that was the position Jackie Robinson played. Flynn grew up Irish Catholic in South Boston. Jackie Robinson was, of course, an African-American who grew up in Southern California. But Flynn says he and his hero had more than just baseball in common. Robinson's father left when he was a baby. Flynn was growing up without his father, too. Stephen Flynn was a dock worker who got sick on the job. He ended up in the hospital for 5 years.
A lot of longshoremen got hurt or sick. There's all kinds of tuberculosis and problems like that. My mother cleaned office buildings at night. So even when I was 10 years old, I had to go out and hustle and try to make a few dollars and try to help my mother out as best as I could.
Flynn shined shoes. He sold newspapers. Sometimes after selling papers at the ballparks, Boston had two major league teams back then, Flynn would stick around to ask for autographs. The city's National League team, the Boston Braves, played just a mile up the road from Fenway Park.
I recall very vividly standing outside the visitors' locker room at Braves Field, as opposed to the home team locker room where all the young kids from Roxbury, Southie, Charlestown, Brighton, all wanted to get the Braves' autographs. I wanted to get the best player's autograph.
And the very best player, at least in the eyes of 10-year-old Ray Flynn, was Jackie Robinson.
So he comes out of the locker room, and I saw him, and I went up to him, and I says, "Mr. Robinson, I said, could I have your autograph?" And he looks at me, and he says, "Sure." So he signs the autograph book for me, and I said, "Mr. Robinson, could I carry your bag?" He looks at me hesitantly, and he says, "Sure, take the bag." So he gave me the bag. I was barely able to carry it. I was so young. I carried the bag up to the taxi stand on the main street. He gets in the taxi. He puts his hand in his pocket and takes out some money. And he says, "Here, kid, thanks for carrying my bag." And I says, "Oh, Mr. Robinson," I says, "I don't want any money." I said, "It was a real honor, you know, to carry your bag." This kid from South Boston here. He looks at me and then he says, "Well, I'll see you again." I says, "Okay, Mr. Robinson," and off he goes to the hotel. You know, I went home and I told my brother, my older brother, and he says, "You mean to say he offered you money and you didn't take it?" "Wow," he says, "I would have taken the money."
Flynn knew his family could use the cash, but he says letting Jackie Robinson know that he had a fan in Boston was more important.
Well, about 2 weeks later, the Dodgers are back in town again. The Brooklyn Dodgers are back in town again playing the Braves. Here I am in the same location, the same situation. About 30 or 40 kids from Boston are all waiting outside the Braves locker room to get the Braves autograph. And I'm there with Jackie Robinson. He looks at me. He says, "You already got my autograph." I said, "Yeah, I got your autograph." I said, "Mr. Robinson, can I carry your bag again?" It would seem like he would always come out of the locker room and he'd look, kind of look around, and he'd see me there. We used to talk back and forth, but he just had this instinct of saying the right thing. He knew how I was dressed. I didn't have expensive clothes, just shabby dungarees and an old sweatshirt. He could tell that there wasn't much money there. But he would just give you these words of encouragement.
Flynn learned everything he could about Robinson's life, not just the statistics, which he can still rattle off, but also about Robinson's time before Major League Baseball, graduating from UCLA, serving as an officer in the Army. Flynn even studied Robinson's family.
I mean, I knew the whole story about Jackie Robinson A to Z. And every time I had the chance of walking with him up to the taxi stand, I'd always bring up some kind of little fact or statistic that would really surprise him, you know, like how I knew all of that. I said to him one time, I said, "Your brother ran in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin with Jesse Owens, the great Jesse Owens." I said, "In the stands was Adolf Hitler." And he says to me, "How old are you?" I says, "I'm 10 years old." He said, "How do you know all this?" Then he says, "I hope you're as smart in math and English as you are about Jackie Robinson's background in history and sports."
The walk from the visitor's clubhouse to the taxi stand on Commonwealth Avenue didn't take long. It couldn't have been more than a block or two. But between those brief encounters and the things he read about Robinson in the papers he sold, Flynn came to realize just how much adversity Robinson had overcome. And he came to realize that he could overcome his circumstances, too.
Nobody told us to go to college. Nobody told us that we could play major league sports. Nobody told us we could be successful. Nobody ever told us that we could achieve anything. And that's what Jackie Robinson did. He used to inspire young people to do things that they probably didn't think they could do.
Ray Flynn became a very good college basketball player. He even made it briefly onto the Boston Celtics roster, but was cut before the season began. Once it became clear that he wasn't going to make it as an athlete, Flynn decided his life's work would be to help kids, kids who were poor, like he had been. First, he was a coach. Then in 1971, he became a state representative. That's when he met Jackie Robinson again.
Just as I was starting to come up, Jackie was starting to fail.
Jackie Robinson had diabetes. By the end, he was almost blind and had trouble walking. Flynn was friendly with the mayor of New York, so he asked for a favor. Could you call Jackie Robinson and see if he'd be up for a visit from a politician from South Boston? Robinson said yes.
So I hopped on the train. I went down to New York. There was a police officer with me, showed me the way. And I went in and I saw Jackie Robinson, invited me right in, he and his wife. He made us sandwiches and we sat and talked. And he said, "Why are you so interested in wanting to talk to me? You know, you were kind of young when I was at my heyday." So I says, "Mr. Robinson," I says, he says, "Stop. You're going to start calling me Jackie now." I says, "Okay." I said, I was the little kid that was waiting outside the visitor's locker room at Braves Field.
"Unbelievable," Ray Flynn remembers Jackie Robinson saying. "You're my number one fan." Flynn isn't sure Robinson actually remembered him. How could he? He must have met so many kids over the years. They talked over the phone a few times after that, but they never again met in person. Robinson died in 1972. Ray Flynn went on to become a city councilor, then mayor in 1983. In 1993, Flynn left Boston to become the ambassador to the Vatican. That's where he became close with Pope John Paul II and Mother Teresa. Ray Flynn lives a quieter life now. He takes care of his grandson, who's disabled. Together, they explore the city. And whenever he gets the chance, Flynn talks about meeting Jackie Robinson. He says it's a story kids today need to hear.
I work with popes, presidents, and prime ministers. I knew two saints, personal friends of two saints. But I learned more about life from Jackie Robinson than I learned from any politician that I ever met.
That was former Boston Mayor Ray Flynn speaking to Only a Game's Karen Given. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.